Coming up next is going to be Jim Aiken and colleagues. Jim's from Bar Engineering, and I'll let him introduce his co-speakers. Together, they're going to be talking about groundwater considerations for gravel mining at Umore Park, background groundwater modeling and monitoring. And let me just point out, this is going to be a little bit of a change of pace here. Here we're going to start talking about sand and gravel operations, move away a little bit from some of the hard rock mining that we've been talking about, but we'll get back to both before the day's done.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Well, I'm proud to be the transition between those things that we mine that are in hard rock and those that we mine in not so hard rock. I'm really excited about this talk. This is the first technical talk of many, I think, that this group will be hearing coming out of the Umore Park area, not just about groundwater, but also regarding surface water and sustainability exercises that will be being developed out at Umore Park in the future. My speakers today, I'm going to give the introduction and a little bit of the background about Umore Park for those that may not be familiar with the project and the site and the university's vision. With me today will be Evan Christensen, who's been doing a lot of the groundwater modeling and looking at a lot of the aspects of the mining project that's proposed for the site. And then also, I'm very, very proud to have Cale Anger, who's a graduate student, one of Calvin Alexander students, that's going to be presenting the baseline monitoring results from the facility. And I talked to our unofficial historian here for MGWA, Gil Gabansky, and Gil assures me that this is the first time in recent memory that a graduate student from the university has presented this august body. So excited about that. I guess moving on. What is Umore Park? It stands for the University of Minnesota Outreach, Research, and Education Park. Umore Park was established originally as an agriculture experiment station at the close of World War II. It's located about 20 miles south of the Twin Cities in Rosemont Empire Township. It occupies about 5,000 acres, and this is just for scale. It's a big area. I think it's important to note that kind of scale of project is pretty unusual in our area, especially for groundwater. It's on that border between site and regional studies that makes it pretty incredible. That outlined area there in black is about the size of St. Louis Park, so it's a good-sized area, the black outline. It's located between the Mississippi River and also the Vermilion River to the south. There's the Mississippi River up here, Vermilion River tributaries to the south. The reason that it's being looked at for aggregate production is because it's located on a broad plateau that received meltwater from the St. Croix Moraine at the last end of the last glacial period. So there were probably a series of glacial events that distributed outwash into this area and resulted in, the technical term is a big pile of gravel. So Umore Park is a unique facility, not just for its aggregate resources, but because of its unique vision that the university has crafted for it. The university started in about 2006. The regents of the university directed staff to look at long-term plans for Umore Park, including sustainable development and stewardship over the land, as well as to look for ways to further the university's mission, as I said, for outreach, research, and education. Furthering not only the teaching mission, but with outreach, helping to provide a livelihood and sustainable economic development for the communities that the university serves. Out of that came the first thing that came out for the gravel resource was a study they commissioned, led by J.D. Lair in concert with ProSource. Also, Jonathan Wilmshurst was a consultant on that project as well. And what they did is they put in a bunch of borings, mostly solid stem augers, but over 600 borings and 5,000 acres. Give you a sense for what that looks like. So they literally Swiss cheese this site. I mean, they put in a lot of. We had a great deal of data that we went through to develop the conceptual model for this site. You'll notice that the eastern side of the site says the former GAO, and I'll get to that in a second. But this is the mining area that is the subject of the EIS that's going to be talked about with Evan and Cale's work. Just some facts on this. They found over 100 feet of economically viable gravel on this west side. The total gravel that's estimated to be here is about 100 million tons, and that's about 2 to 3 times what the annual metropolitan area demand is for gravel. The whole site together is about 360 million. And you'll notice that the east side isn't part of the Umore mining plan, the UMA as we call it. And that's because it's the where the former Gopher Ordnance Works sets. And the Gopher Ordnance Works was a 1940 era World War II gunpowder and munitions plant. It was used to develop smokeless gunpowder. It really only operated for about 7 months in 1945, and that being the case, it was built and constructed in a very short period of time in the 40s. And what's left out there right now is a great deal of ruins that create, let's just say, some additional complexity to a gravel mining operation. So it was determined pretty early on that it would be probably a little bit easier to look at this western area where there wasn't as much interference from past industrial land use. The Umore mining area was developed and the plan was hatched to look at a phased mining development over 40 years to mine out the 100 million or so tons of gravel that are here. Some of this gravel is located beneath the water table in these yellow areas. And this area in particular is of interest because the plan calls for this to become a post-mining pit lake that will be then used for later recreational use and become an asset to the local community. Another aspect of the mining plan is that it will involve dredge mining in this lake area. It will not require dewatering, so there's no dewatering operation involved in this. There is going to be, however, some pumping wells and some production wells that would be installed, and Evan's going to talk a little bit more about that. So what were some of the key issues that came up? Both internally and externally, the university recognized that there was a potential for this site to have some effects on the local environment, and they wanted to look at those in great detail and understand what those were before they moved forward with the project. One of the early concerns was that having this massive pit lake would be a source of thermal insulation so that incoming sunlight would warm that lake water, and then that warm lake water then would transfer to the glacial aquifer. And because this site is located near the Vermilion River, which is an outstanding trout stream, the concern was that this cold water stream would be influenced would be negatively influenced by this warm water. And I'll skip to the end and tell you that we found out that that's not the case. The groundwater actually flows to the northeast under Umore. But just to give you an idea how important a lot of this research is that information, that simple fact, which way is the groundwater flowing, was not clearly known when we started. Some other concerns that come up will be the effect of drawdown from the mining operation on water resources, and also what the long-term effects will be. And Cale will be discussing that in his, he's going to talk about some of the baseline monitoring and the things that they found looking at the groundwater at the site. Just real quick, this groundwater study is one of several ongoing investigations at Umore Park. In addition, this is not the end. We're going to talk about just the groundwater modeling today and the baseline monitoring. In order to get there, though, we did a pretty extensive drilling operation. Jim Items in the crowd here. Jim was managing that project and with Janet Doglish and Stephen Lott at the university. And in addition to that, we also have done some environmental investigations, which are ongoing. And we'll talk about that another time. So we started in the winter of 2008 developing the groundwater model, the geologic conceptual model that then was used to construct the groundwater model, dealt with all the other issues. For more information on the broader context of Umore Park, please visit the Umore webpage at www.umore.park.umn.edu. And with that, I'll turn it over to Evan, If you do have questions, please hold them to the end. I'm sure that there might be some questions that come up, but we'll have a little mini panel afterwards if there's time. So with Evan, that, I'll turn it over to Evan. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So just a brief overview of what I'm going to discuss, and it's, you know, Jim went over the history. I'm going to focus on the hydrogeology, so maybe that will spark some interest. As Jim mentioned, we did the hydrogeologic assessment. That involved developing a conceptual model characterizing the hydrogeology in hydrogeologic properties of both the outwash and in somewhat the till in the vicinity, and characterizing groundwater flow. And once we were able to develop a pretty reasonable site conceptual model, we developed the groundwater model. And then we used that groundwater model to evaluate the effects on mining, simulate future conditions, and then use the modeling results to help guide some of the mine planning. A brief overview of the hydrogeologic assessment. As Jim showed, there was, you know, over 600 borings done for the gravel resource assessment. And we went in and targeted a few key locations where we needed some additional water levels and some stratigraphy, and to identify some locations for pumping tests. We installed 13 more monitoring wells, a pumping well for our pumping tests, some pilot borings to refine the stratigraphy, conducted a aquifer test. And at that point, after we had collected all this additional data, we felt like we had a pretty good handle on our conceptual model. So just here's a map of our pilot borings and monitoring wells throughout the entire UMORE site, and then not necessarily just the gravel mining area, and then our pumping tests of the glacial outwash done there, fairly high hydraulic conductivities, 200 feet per day horizontally, 100 feet per day vertical. Initially, when we went into this, we sort of had this idea that it's this massive outwash plain with all this gravel, and it's going to be very simple geology, gravel over bedrock. A lot of the gravel resource borings, they only really went to where they would touch till or bedrock and didn't go any deeper beyond that. And once we went in and did the additional monitoring wells and pilot borings, we discovered there really is an extensive amount of till at depth below the superficial glacial outwash, shown here with the blue blobs. Blobs is also a technical term, Jim told me. And so that really played an important role in how we developed the conceptual model of the site. Also, we refined the bedrock topography. Once we were able to compile all of these boring data, we looked at the existing bedrock topography and refined it. The blue areas on these it's just one figure, is high areas, and the blue are low areas. So there's a northeast trending valley in this area, and then also this is sort of a larger feature once we get off-site. And in the bedrock valleys at depth, there's often a sort of basal outwash unit, and the conceptual model is that a lot of the groundwater flow goes under the till through these bedrock valleys in the outwash. This is a southwest to northeast cross-section through the entire UMORE site, just pointing out the extent of the till unit there shown in brown with the superficial outwash at the surface. There is some loess in topsoil, of course, as well, and then a basal outwash unit. Most of the time, the first bedrock is either St. Peter in the bedrock highs and Prairie du Chien in the bedrock valley areas. And another cross-section north to south, again, showing the extent of the till. This till became important in mine planning, especially in sort of this area, to help us locate some of the production facilities and to help reduce any potential vulnerabilities from surface spills or anything that would occur at the production facilities. So conceptual models, Jim mentioned, we didn't really know going into it if flow was to the Vermilion River or to the north, to the Mississippi River, or even potentially to the northwest, to the Minnesota River. It is fairly close to groundwater divides for both. The divide to the Vermilion River is approximately in here. So south of there, flow is to the Vermilion River, but everywhere from the site, flow is to the northeast towards the Mississippi. This is just a classic example of the entire UMORE site is within the Vermilion River watershed, but it's not within the Vermilion River groundwater shed. cross-section of the conceptual model. This area here is sort of the main area for gravel extraction, and when we get below the water table, that's where we'll form the pit lake. Flow is mostly around the till and under the till as well, under the till into the bedrock, and in some of the deeper incised valleys back out of the bedrock into the outwash. So we had our conceptual model. We could then go in and build our groundwater flow model, and the purpose of the groundwater flow model is to help us test the conceptual model and then also test different hypotheses regarding potential impacts from the mining, and then to evaluate any possible mitigations from any impacts that could be identified. The UMOR groundwater model is a TMR, or telescopic mesh refinement, of the Twin Cities Metro Model 2. It's the Twin Cities Metro Model is a 9-layer mod flow model that covers the entire Twin Cities area, and we went in and did a TMR so we could refine the scale of things, shrink our cell size down, and add some additional layers. So the Metro Model 2 was used to define the boundary conditions for our UMOR model, and as I said, two additional layers were added to help simulate flow in the quaternary so we could really more accurately put in the till body that we had identified. Here's a cross-section through the model. Put up more proper terms that we are now adopting. And it's, as you can see, it includes all the major aquifers in the Twin Cities, all the way down to the Mount Simon. Having a model all the way down to the Mount Simon really is sort of overkill for this sort of project, but because we are using the Twin Cities Metro model as our base model, we were able to maintain that consistency all the way down to the UMOR model. And then some results from the model itself fits very well with our field data. Calibration was pretty much very excellent, in my opinion. Flow towards the Mississippi River. These are particle tracks, these little gray lines. Particle tracks from the UMA, the mining area, all to the northeast towards the Mississippi River, and some being captured by the Flint Hills Resource Refinery production wells. So we had our calibrated model. We could then use it to do some predictive simulations to assess any potential impacts from the modeling or from the mining. A few of these simulations were, one, to get a handle on what would be a sustainable pumping rate. We needed to pump some water for wash operations and concrete production. Like Jim said, we didn't need to dewater, but there would still be some withdrawal from the aquifer. Test the effect of mining-related impacts. That's mostly what is the impact of having a pit lake at the site, and then the effects of future municipal demand. The part of the UMA is within the DWISMA for the city of Rosemont, and as there's growth and development and increased demand, what is going to happen to the drinking water supply management areas for the city of Rosemont and also Empire Township to the southwest. Here's water use at the site. Initially, the idea was to draw over 2,000 gallons per minute from the outwash to use for gravel washing. We need to be able to wash the gravel of its fines. And it was recognized very early that that is not a sustainable rate. We would probably need many wells in the outwash and also the deeper aquifers in the Jordan or the Prairie du Chien. And that really became non-feasible pretty quickly. So instead, what is proposed is to have a clay settlement and recirculation basin, which would be filled once, pumping from the outwash, and then water for wash water would be recirculated from that basin, and only having makeup water from lossage from evaporation and seepage back into that recirculation basin. And then also a small amount of water pumped from the Prairie du Chien for concrete production. Here's some model output from a predictive simulation. This is basically just having the wells for the wash water, which is that yellowish greenish dot, and then for the concrete production, which is that purplish dot, and then the settlement basin itself into the model as well. And really all this is showing that it's not an extreme amount of pumping once we have the clay-lined recirculation basin, and groundwater flow is really not affected under this simulation. This would be drawdown for that same simulation. About a tenth of a foot is this dashed line here. This would be in the superficial aquifer, and a little more near the well. And then an increase in water levels underneath this settlement basin from induced recharge from the leakage from that recirculation basin. The next step was to look at, well, once we're mining below the water table and we extend this pit lake, what are the implications for that? And this is just a comparison. It's nothing small by any means. This is pit lake compared to Lake Nokomis. It would be bigger than Lake Nokomis. And this would be similar to Lake Elmo. This would be Lake Elmo kind of turned upside down and on its side. But fairly large. If I had a nice little path running around this lake, it would definitely be a pretty good workout. So this is similar to that last simulation, but with the lake into the model as well. Flow is still towards the northeast of the Mississippi River. Essentially, the pit lake becomes a flow-through lake, with flow coming in from the south and west and leaving on the north and east, with slight divergences around this sort of bays of the lake. And this would be change in water levels with the lake. This is a little confusing to understand. Basically, the lake acts as a body of water with, you know, essentially zero hydraulic gradient. So where the gradient previously, if you have arms of the leg up gradient, and now you have this sort of zero gradient lake body within that, you have a reduction in water levels there, and the reverse on the opposite side, an increase in water levels on the down gradient side. Overall, a slight increase, mostly due to superficial runoff into the lake, sort of in the lake acting sort of as this area of focus recharge. And as I mentioned, the other concern was increase in municipal demand for the city of Rosemont and neighboring communities such as Empire Township. And so we tried to incorporate that using projections by the Metropolitan Council out to the year 2050. This shows Metropolitan Council projections for Rosemont, are the lower bars there and the upper bars there are Empire Township. So Rosemont going from 910 million gallons per year to 3.6 billion gallons per year in the year 2050, and Empire Township going from 80 million to 517 million. So along with this increase in municipal demand and the pumping associated with that, we looked at changes in land use with that same growth. And as part of the initial model calibration, we used a new model that we've been using on several projects. It's a USGS model, surface water balance, or SWB model, to establish recharge. And this, I'm not going to go through this whole diagram, but these are sort of all the inputs that go into the SWB model. And the key one for this study is the ability to change land cover and see what the resultant changes in recharge. And so we were able to take projected land use changes for Rosemont and surrounding communities of Umore and incorporate that into our future 2050 projections. This is the result of those 2050 simulations looking at the capture zones for wells of Empire Township and Rosemont. The orange dots are existing wells and blue dots are future wells. The future wells are put in based on existing well capacities and the number of wells that would be needed to meet the projected demand, and then put them in locations of planned well fields. This orange line is the Umore mining area, and as you can see, the porous media capture zones and the fracture flow capture zones intersect that area and the drinking water supply management as well. And we were able to take this information and also look at the vulnerability of the aquifer to surface contamination and move the ancillary use facilities to an area that is outside of this projected year 2050 drinking water supply management area and into an area that has low aquifer vulnerability. The low aquifer vulnerability is a result of that thick sequence of till, especially in this area. There is some concern about storage of fuels and other liquids on the site that they need for support. And so we were able to, with a little bit of reworking, move that facility to areas where the aquifer's vulnerability is low and we're outside of any future DWSMAs. Kale?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm pleased to be here today as, I guess, the first graduate student to present at Minnesota Groundwater Association. So I'm proud to present some of my work, I guess, in conjunction with Barr's work. And essentially what I did for the UMAR site is looked at some baseline monitoring data and looked at different mechanisms that influence the groundwater patterns that we see. An overview of what I'll be discussing, I'll be talking about some of the project goals and objectives, the main groundwater assessment that we did, and then how this plays into sustainable groundwater at the site. So when I began this project, I really tried to look into the history of the site and tried to pull together as much data as I could in terms of groundwater records, geochemistry, those types of things, and really constrain what types of parameters really needed to be investigated for the site. And this investigation was supplemental to Barr's work and also to supplement the EIS. So the different parameters that we looked at for groundwater were groundwater elevation, temperature, and geochemistry, fairly typical variables. And we were able to collect time series and point scale data over a year period to characterize the background characteristics of the site. So the main goal of this project is to really understand how this data fits into sustainable groundwater at UMAR Park. And one of the fundamental goals of monitoring is to be able to collect data over a multi-year period and be able to use that physical data to calibrate models and to use it as an inexpensive parameter for testing the hydrologic parameters in the system. So the main points of my talk today will focus on some of the basic data that we have. I'll discuss the monitoring wells and where I monitored, the temporal and spatial groundwater variability, and then also some of the physical groundwater characteristics, as I mentioned, temperature, specific conductivity, and geochemistry. So this is pretty difficult to see, but generally what you want to look at here is the area outlined in black is the UMAR site, and the wells that I looked at, the shallow wells in the quaternary are in the southwestern portion of the site, and then I have two wells in the northeastern portion of the site that are in the Prairie du Chien. In addition, there is one well south of the site that I initially monitored early on just to get an idea of how surface waters influence the groundwater in the region. And this is not really an area of concern for us. We know that the groundwater flows to the northeast, but it was more of a scientific investigation on our part. So to start off with, we look at groundwater variability. And if you focus on the figure at the right, you can see that there's not a significant amount of fluctuation. The plots at the top here show groundwater elevation in the quaternary aquifer, fairly stable, and we are seeing some recharge in March. But conversely, if you look at the Prairie du Chien aquifer, we are seeing declining groundwater levels, and it's been recorded in the two wells that I've been looking at. And the important thing with this is to really analyze this and to continue monitoring and make sure that we have a time constant on how long it takes for that aquifer to recharge and basically how long it takes for the system to respond to precipitation events. And these data are essentially some of the temperature monitoring that we've been doing at the site. On both of these plots here at the top. So at the top here of each of these plots, I've plotted the average daily temperature in red here. You can see the fluctuation with the seasons. The monitoring period starts in June and goes until June 2009, and it goes until March 2010. So you see the changes in temperature. Black is precipitation. Blue is snowfall, or snowpack, I guess, in events of snowfall. And on the left-hand side of the diagram here, we have shallow groundwater wells, three examples here. And in all cases, what we're seeing is we're seeing a dampened sinusoidal trend of temperature that correlates with surface temperatures, which is what we generally see in shallow aquifers in Minnesota. On the right here, we have two of our deeper monitoring wells. This is the lower part of the quaternary here. It's fairly stable over the time period. We don't see any significant correlation with surface temperatures. And then this plot right here is a Prairie du Chien well, so it's fairly constant over time. And then the last image on this plot you see here is this distinct increase in temperature over time. The far left here is the summer months, and the peak occurs in November. And as I mentioned earlier, this is our well south of the site. It's fairly shallow. It's only 19 feet deep. And essentially, this is to show that we're seeing a significant influence from surface temperatures, and we're seeing that the temperatures are 4 months out of phase with what we see with respect to average daily temperatures. And our hypothesis on this is purely just to look at the science behind it, but it focuses on looking at heat transfer through a clay and how long that takes. And there's some modeling that's behind that, but I won't be discussing that today. This plot shows the same precipitation and temperature plot at the top, and then we have specific conductivity in one of our quaternary wells, temperature, and then groundwater elevation. Again, it's pretty constant over the time period we're looking at, and again, we're seeing our recharge event later on in March. And then finally, the last plot with our parameters here show specific conductivity for a Prairie du Chien well. This rapid increase here is actually from when the well was pumped out. I was collecting a geochemical sample that day. And I guess I'm thinking that what happened was it's an older well, and there wasn't very good flow occurring in the well screen. And after I pumped it, it brought in fresh aquifer water and increased the specific conductivity. Temperature is fairly constant. And as I mentioned earlier, with the groundwater elevations, we have a steady decline here, something to keep an eye on. And then finally, the last data that I have to show here focus on some of the results from our groundwater geochemistry. And this is more interesting, I guess, in terms of analysis. But essentially what we're looking at in this plot is chloride to bromide ratios. And many of you may be familiar with this. But we're looking at chloride to bromide ratios for the site with respect to spatial distribution and temporal distribution of the different wells. The x-axis is chloride, y-axis is bromide. And these different arrows here show the ratios of different source waters or chemistries. And what we see here with this arrow is we have the Minnesota rain chemistry, which is about 200 to 250 to 1 for chloride to bromide ratio, and then wastewater to manure, and then fertilizers. And to summarize what these are showing, we're generally seeing that the shallow groundwater wells on site are getting most of their source water from Umar Park. We're seeing higher chloride concentrations that are more basically more representative of manure or fertilizer applications. And then as you get deeper down in the aquifers and down into the Prairie du Chien, we migrate towards this line towards Minnesota rainfall, which essentially indicates that the source water for these wells is not distinctly from Umar Park by itself, but it may be coming from more distal sources. So to summarize what I'm talking about today, this is just a beginner's analysis, I guess, of the groundwater data, provide some baseline data. And the entire idea behind this is to really assess the physical and chemical properties of the aquifer, and then to continue to collect data as we mine the aggregate, and then in the future, to provide a comprehensive monitoring network. This is a very rare thing. As many of you know, a lot of times you don't get the data before you do the project, especially for continuous data. So this is a unique project in terms of doing that. And then also to consider increased municipal demand, as Evan mentioned earlier. And then to summarize this, essentially what we want to do is continue the monitoring efforts in the future and just make sure we address current agricultural use effects on groundwater, aggregate mining, and then future regional development. So thank you. That's my portion. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them.
So the question was, will the pit lake be lined? And the answer is that no, the pit lake is it's going to be a man-made lake with flow through from the lake to the aquifer. So Amal, the question was, we showed the flow lines before development of the mine, and I think your question is, will we show flow after the lake is in? And is that right, Amal? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. One of the unique things about this is the university is uniquely positioned to keep the research going, and they will continue to monitor the site as the mine develops and as the lake is develops. For modeling, okay, yeah. Oh, you mean, oh, yeah, simulating it, right. I was thinking reality. Oh, shoot, yeah. You want to handle that up?
Yeah. You just want to know if we did particle tracking once we put in the lake. Is that... Okay. Yeah. Yes. It shows you do see that flow around the till, but as far as the effect of the lake, you really only see deviations in flow very near the lake itself. Regionally, flow is pretty much the same.
No, that was one of the interesting things about this site is that it is the topography drains all runoff towards the Vermilion watershed. However, some of the surface water modeling that BAR has done pretty clearly show that you need a 1-inch 24-hour rainfall to get any runoff at all. Even then, the water moves a relatively short distance and then reinfiltrates. So this, as Evan indicated, this is one of those situations where the watershed is completely or is separate from the ground watershed flow directions. About 100 feet, I think, 110 feet. I'm getting nods. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Any other questions?
Sure.
Another great question. I should probably touch on that. The actual mining is being done by Dakota Aggregates LLC. And the university has formed a separate LLC from the university to oversee and serve as a board of governors for Dakota Aggregates. So no, the university is not in the mining business. However, they do have control to make sure that the mining is conducted in accordance with the university's vision and their principles of stewardship for the property. The question is, what are the other groundwater quality problems that are associated with surface mining versus subaqueous mining, I guess we'll call it? I don't know if our panel whispering back and forth here. I think the only thing we can, you know, perhaps some suspended solids that might be generated, but the aquifer and the lake would tend to filter that out. So the other major source of contamination for any mining operation is, you know, to be mindful of operations. And one of the things that we did do in planning this mine was to be very careful about where we put fueling areas and liquid storage and put those in an area that is has a lower vulnerability to groundwater impact. So, all right, how are we doing on time here? One more question? Any more questions? All right.